FGI Podcast 2.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are and when you're listening to this podcast. This is Daniel Cornwall, a free government information volunteer, and I'd like to welcome you back for our second episode of the FGI podcast. That was Jim Jacobs announcing that this was, in fact, FGI podcast number 2. So, in our last podcast, if you heard me, I was so concerned about getting everything just right that I prepared scripts for absolutely every intro, and I thought I came across as sounding extremely scripted. So I've decided to try and toss the script today and wing it, as it were. And I'm hoping that we'll get some listener feedback as to whether you prefer winging or whether you prefer scripting. And there'll be contact information towards the end of our podcast and also in the show notes. On today's episode, our first segment is going to be an FGI roundtable. We were able to get a group of FGI volunteers, not all of us, but most of us, and we're able to introduce ourselves, tell a little bit about what led us to start working with the group Free Government Information, and what I thought were some pretty exciting discussions on the major issues facing us, facing all of us in access to government information now and in the future. After that, we're going to have Elizabeth Cowell of Stanford University give a talk on the GPO LOCKS pilot project. And that talk was originally given at the Spring 2007 Depository Library Conference. And we'll have a link to her presentation slides and to the LOCKS project and to the Spring 2007 Depository Library Conference in our show notes. Then we're going to do our regular podcast sampler segment, and this time it'll be a real short one that you as a podcaster would be very welcome to just drop into your podcasts. But more about that when the time comes. And then we're going to be closing with some exciting independent music from musician Claire Danes. So, without further ado, let's listen to the FGI Roundtable. Hello again, this is Daniel Cornwall with Free Government Information, and today all of us volunteers decided it'd be good to get together, those of us that could make it, and give you a sense of our other voices, not just me, and talk a little bit about what drew us into working with Free Government Information and what we see the important issues being. So, we got together beforehand and thought of some questions that would be good to ask ourselves. It's always a little awkward when a group interviews itself, but we'll give it a try. And the first question is, what brought you to work with FGI, with Free Government Information? And I think I'll actually take this question first, because in some ways it's the easiest for me. I got to work with Free Government Information because James A. Jacobs, James R. Jacobs, and Xinjun Yao were kind enough to ask me to come work with them. And
or to duke you into it.
And I guess that I became aware of them and wanted to work with them because I read their paper, the Once and Future Federal Depository Library Program, which I thought was just absolutely spot on how the system of federal depository libraries had to had to change and grow into the 21st century while doing all the things that we've done well, having custody of our items and providing access and giving people privacy. So I read that paper and I was just so thrilled about it that I was praising it to the skies everywhere. And then a couple weeks later, I found out that the people who wrote the paper were coming up with this website and organization and actually wanted me to come out and hang with them. And I just thought that was terrific.
Well, I guess I can jump in on this. This is James R. Jacobs. I think Jim and Shinjung and I, after we wrote that paper, that paper really was a kickoff for a lot of things and a lot of collaboration between us and between others as well. But we wrote the paper. It was largely Jim's energy and impetus, I think, and Shinjung and I did a little editing here and there, kind of trimmed the edges. We wanted to get the paper out to more than just the people who would read the Journal of Academic Librarianship. And so we thought of ways that we could do that, and one of the ways we thought would be the perfect way to do it would be to build a site around the article and to be able to, you know, send a link out to people. And Jim and I and Shinjung had all been blogging for quite a while before FreeGovInfo came up on blogs like Library Autonomous Zone and Diglett, and Shinjung has a blog. I don't know if she wants me to tell what her blog name is. She's shaking her head here, no. But we'd all been blogging for a while, and so we thought, well, let's combine the information and the passion that we thought was in the article, and we combine it with a blog and make it an ongoing conversation and hopefully invite others and get that conversation going both within the community, the government documents community, as well as reaching out to journalists and policymakers and other people.
And I can just add what James said about not just working in a library, because government documents issues is not about library. There are a lot of other, pretty much all the citizens are affected by government documents. So we try to find a way to reach out beyond the library community. That's, I think, we come up with the website.
Well, I'll jump in. This is Jim Jacobs, James A. Jacobs. And let me first say that James R. Jacobs and Shinjung are being modest, that we contributed equally to that paper. And I don't think it would have gotten written if it was only myself working on it. It was truly a collaborative effort. And in terms of getting involved with FreeGovInfo and getting it started and everything, I think, again, I have to credit them with a lot of the impetus of getting it going. They were starting at UCSD and had only been there for a year or two. I had been there for dozens of years, it seemed like, at that point. And they had a lot of enthusiasm and interest in doing things in new ways. And we were all sitting around the dinner table with another colleague one night when we started thinking about and brainstorming ways to do this. And to follow up on what Shinjung said, one of our goals was to reach beyond the library community, beyond the GovDocs community, and find others who rely on government information, make sure that we could communicate with them, and they had a path to communicate back into the library community through us. Thus was born FreeGovInfo. Daniel?
Okay, great. So that brings us to our next question, and which issue in regards to government information are you most concerned about? Any takers?
I'll jump in on that. This is Jim. I think the thing that concerns me most in some ways is the library community itself, librarians.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really concerned that it's been so long since we've been moving to a digital environment for government information, and the library community has been, I think, slow to come up with new and innovative ways of dealing with government information that would ensure its long-term preservation. We've, I think, relied too much on others, the Googles and the GPOs mm-hmm. and the Internet Archives and the House of Congress and others, hoping that somebody else would do the work that individual libraries have always been responsible for in the past. So one of my biggest concerns is that libraries aren't moving fast enough to come up with innovative ways of dealing with these things individually.
And I can agree more on that too, because technology is constantly changing and we don't know what we'll land it to in the future. But I think that the library community that think that this is a huge task no one wants to take on. And it's not necessarily having to be lots of funding to do it. I think they're sometimes willing to do it. Can be small portion people, small library can contribute to the ideas. And in the process, we will figure out some way to long-term preservation and the access. But like Jim said, we can access it. We can link to something so they don't see the immediate need of preservation. And our role is ended right there. I think that's in the danger. I'm less worried about what technology will work or not, but I really worry about community of a library community doesn't really think way to do, the willingness to do, and the importance of the issues. I think that's my concern as well too.
Yeah, I think I would jump on that. What excites me about the digital era is that these technologies are built for collaborative use. I've really been interested in peer-to-peer technologies, not just for the Napster music files that I never downloaded, but you know some people may have done that. But that idea where you can use a network of libraries, the idea is not a new idea. I think the Federal Depository Library Program is a network of libraries collaboratively collecting and preserving government documents, and for some reason there's a disconnect in the community that old idea, that traditional idea, quote unquote, is somehow different or somehow not appropriate for the digital era. And I think in fact that old idea is exactly what the digital era allows us to do even more. You know, the fact that Xinjing and I are sitting here in our living room in San Francisco, and Jim is in San Diego, and Daniel is in Soggy, Alaska. that's the technology that allows us to get together and talk to each other. That technology also allows us to collect collaboratively. You know, we don't all have to have massive databases of digital objects. We can share those objects. We can collect the little things that are interesting to us, and help others to collect other things that are interesting to them. Am I going off the track here at all? Or?
Sounds pretty focused to me.
Yeah. Okay. So we've written a little bit on our website about the issues that are of importance to us. In terms of access, authenticity, preservation, and privacy. I wonder if anybody wants to jump in on those or whether they're self-evident.
Well, I think we've touched on preservation, and mm-hmm. if our listeners want to look at our other issues, they could go to freegovinfo.info/issues, and they would get to what we wrote up on the website. Just obviously already jumped in here, but one of my big concerns is preservation, but I think we've already talked about that a bit. Neck and neck with preservation, I'd have to say, for the lack of a better word, is lack of publicity or awareness. Because in our society, we are just totally surrounded by government information, in the sense that any time that someone writes in a newspaper or they're on Fox or CNN and say, you know, 25 million Americans have whatever piece of technology or had rice for dinner the night before, it's generally going to trace back to some sort of government statistic that's been gathered at government expense, and often the people that the information was gathered from were doing so under mandatory reporting requirements. So, you know, in a society where we've paid to have the information collected, where in some cases there are penalties for refusing to give the information to the government, people just don't seem to be that aware that the information is out there and that there is this network of over 1,200 libraries that desire nothing more than to help them find all this stuff.
That's one of the reasons why I think blogging is very important. And I've talked to lots of people in the community, and lots of people say, "Geez, I don't know how you have the energy to do it," or my administration doesn't allow me to blog or to do any of that because they don't see it as interesting or whatever. Just if I can give a little anecdote to show why blogging could be really important for libraries. A couple of weeks ago, I got a reference question on the average tariff level for a bunch of different countries. I'm an international documents librarian, so I get these international statistical questions lots of times. I used to rely on my old data librarian friend Jim, but now I have to do it myself. So I was going out and looking at all the normal standard statistical resources for international information, Source OECD, the World Development Indicators, UN Common Database, etc. And I couldn't quite find exactly what I wanted to. And so I started searching online for it, and I didn't find the answer that I wanted to, but I blogged about it on the Information Center, on the blog that we have at our library, both the question and the answer for how I found it, how I got to it. And so if I blog that one thing, the next time somebody is looking for average tariff levels, which in an academic situation is fairly regularly, if they were to do, you know, the first thing that most people do is to do a Google search for average tariff levels, now they'll find my blog post describing the question and the answer and how I got to those, to that data, a lot faster than it took me and several of my colleagues in our library, you know, a couple of days of looking at lots of different resources and finally coming up with the information for the user. But now, because I blogged it, somebody can do a search and they'll find exactly what they need right away. So if librarians, extending that to, you know, general library practice, if librarians were to blog about the questions they get and the answers they come up with, that would be really helpful, and that would do things like highlight their collections and make things easier to find and do the things that librarians normally do, is to help people find the information they need to answer the questions they need.
That's a very creative use of the blog there. I wanted to point out that at least in terms of highlighting documents, there do seem to be a fair number of blogs by document librarians that have sprung up. Like Lori Smith does alerts people to new statistics on MySpace. And the Washington State Library has something called Documents in the News. And the Montana State Library has a similar service. And we've got a few others that mostly say, hey, there's these new documents coming out. And we actually have a section on our site for that called In Other News. And if you go to our freegovinfo.info, and at the top of any page, click In Other News, you'll see postings from those blogs as well as others. But I think that James really hit on something that while it's good and necessary to highlight in terms of collections or new resources, explaining how we use that information and where you can find it in response to specific questions is also very valuable.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the blog allows us to do to sort of brag about what it is that we do. You know, when we go out and talk to people who aren't librarians, whenever we tell them what we do and sort of describe our processes, they're always amazed at how much information we know and have our hands are close at hand, and how creative we are in answering those questions. And so, you know, we need to really start tooting our own horn, so to speak. And I think the blog can really help that.
I think that's the important part for it, but at the same time, without preservations and access, etc., we cannot do these things. You know, we can use the blog to advertise for our collection if we don't collect. So I think that's really important, coming back, thinking about, you know, provide a service to the wider community. What we all have been doing, it, it's really important to think about how we need to preserve this material in the long term, not only preserve and make it accessible to anyone. That's really important.
A very good point.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to read you something that I came across today. This is, I actually found this on Ex Libris, which is a weekly electronic magazine by Mary Lane Block. And she has a page of interesting quotations that she found, and this particular one is from Paul Graham writing about Web 2.0 from 2 years ago, November 2005.
Wow.
And Graham said, was talking about Google and comparing it to libraries. He says, Google doesn't try to force things to happen their way. They try to figure out what's going to happen and arrange to be standing there when it does. That's the way to approach technology. And as business includes an even larger technological component, the right way to do business. I think that's where libraries ought to be. We ought to be trying to figure out where things are going to be and not trying to hope that the technology will follow our wise lead. I don't think we can hope that and think that it will actually work. Things change outside of our ability to influence them technologically, and people's habits and expectations change outside of our ability to control, which is a good thing, but we need to adjust our own ways of dealing with the content and expertise that we have in our libraries to make sure that we're linking that content up with users and users with that content. I don't know where that came from, guys, but I'm just it seemed to fit in with the general discussion we were having about technology and libraries.
And I think we're not a Google. I think sometimes we try, library try to compete with the Google. And I don't think we can compete. And we have a different mission. So I think that sometimes we're talking about a lot of things, but really thinking about what is our role, what is, you know, our traditional role, I think be centered, that's a really important part as well, too.
Definitely makes a lot of sense. And I think that it might be a good idea to let it lay there for the time being, because I see that we're about at the half hour mark, and one of the commitments we tried to make as a group in these podcasts were not to let any one segment exceed an hour, any one episode to exceed an hour. So unless there's something other people want to say.
No, I think
okay.
I think we've spouted off long enough.
Really good conversation, though. Our next segment is an excerpt from a talk originally given at the Spring 2007 Depository Library Conference meeting in Denver, Colorado. The talk is excerpted from a session on locks, and was given by Elizabeth Cowell of Stanford University and one of the members of the Locks Project team. And it was the Locks perspective on the GPO Locks pilot project, which GPO ran for a couple of years with a number of libraries, including my own library. And it covered, well, I should let Elizabeth tell you about the project. But from the library side, we found it to be very successful. GPO found it less so, and Elizabeth is going to talk about that. Take it away, Elizabeth.
The GPO Locks pilot has been going on for, I want to say, 18 months. And we worked with GPO pretty closely, and we're really happy to have this opportunity to work with federal government information. Here's the URL, just to kind of the main page of the pilot. It has now concluded, and a final report has been released. There were, let's see here, how many pilot partners? Many pilot partners. I've got it in two screens to split it up, just so you can see. And the interesting part of this, I think I sent one message to gov.gl announcing the pilot, and a majority of these libraries actually joined the Locks Alliance to be part of this pilot. So, and we had to say no to some people, too, because there are so many people willing to participate. So I think that's a good message that, you know, people are interested in this type of technology. Everyone was really enthusiastic about it, and you'll hear more from Patricia about Georgia Tech's experience. Here's some more. Lots of people working with Locks. So Scott was formerly at the Yale University Law Library. Now he's at a non-alliance member school. So, so the pilot final report, what was the pilot intended to test? According to the pilot report, it was looking at distribution, a distribution method for e-journals. They're concerned that there wasn't a way to distribute these to participating libraries effectively. What was the pilot not intended to test is preservation. We see Locks, Locks staff, and the pilot partners see it as a preservation mechanism. And so if this is a way that things can be in many places and preserve, that's great. So the GPO, you know, wants to use it as part of their preservation system, that's terrific, but that's kind of the way we see it. There are a couple of outstanding issues highlighted in the report, and I just wanted to mention these things briefly. I saw, and there could be more big issues, the issues of recalling publications. Now, occasionally, as you all know, as depository libraries, agencies want us to take things off our shelves and destroy them or whatever. And it could be for a variety of reasons. Typos, wasn't intended for the public. Sometimes it's political. Lots of reasons. It doesn't happen, in my experience. The Locks team can take things out of cache. It is possible to get stuff out of those boxes. It's not particularly easy, but it is possible. The GPO wanted to work on streamlining that process so it was easier, and I personally think it's good if it's hard, you know, because we want a public conversation about what's being taken off the shelves, whether it be virtual or paper. And I think probably a lot of you agree, too. I know some decisions have been reversed over the years because of the depository library's conversations about what is being recalled. So I think the libraries, you know, they want to know what's happening. You don't want to find out that something's been recalled and taken out without knowing about it. I think we need to have the conversation. Another concern was Alliance membership. I think, you know, if we can make a deal with the entire United Kingdom, we can probably work out a deal with the GPO that's reasonable. And so I don't think that needs to be seen as a big issue. Finally, there's GPO staff time. I am not a techie. I will just say that right off the top. So it'll probably take me a really long time to do any of these things, except for click the box to add something to the Locks box. But according to the Locks team, a lot of the stuff that time it took to do the Locks-related tasks that the GPO had in the report were because they were republishing the information. Lots of it. I think they estimated about 90% of the time was because things were being republished. And I think Locks doesn't normally do that. We just go straight from the website, take it down into the caches. So my feeling about that is that if it takes that long to republish, GPO is going to have that problem with any technology they pick. If they need to republish and they decide to do that, that's not the fault of Locks. From the pilot partner's perspective, the pilot was valuable because it tested a distributed model for digital library collections, depository collections. I think everybody, you know, we talk a lot about digital deposit, all this kind of stuff. What does it mean? You know, it sounds kind of scary. You know, I don't want to have this huge repository. I think the partners walked away with, that's it? You know, that's all it did? And I think Scott's going to show us a little more about that I think it made the depositories involved feel like they were part of permanent public access, and we like that. I don't think we want to be in the business of just pointing to web pages. I think we like to be part of the process, you know, as we've been in the print environment. And again, it showed how easy and efficient Logs is to use. So, just kind of imagining for the future, what would it be like if Logs powered an EFDLP? The libraries would select, organize, enhance access, provide service, and preserve what they want in their collections. The GPO would identify, capture, describe, meaning catalog, authenticate, and affirmatively disseminate to these libraries federal web-based content. So that's what it could look like. I'm not saying that it will. It just is a, you know, kind of pie in the sky. I believe that part depository libraries must demand to be part of the preservation system of the FDLP. I think if there's a question on any future biennial survey asking if we want a digital deposit, say yes. I think the risk of loss when all government information is on government servers is too high. I think we need to act like libraries and collect things locally. What is the future for Logs Docs? Well, Logs is continuing to discuss government information and what we can do with it on the state level, even the federal level. I think we really enjoyed this pilot and enjoyed working with GPO on this content. And we don't want to say goodbye as a group. So this Logs pilot group continues to discuss government information. Would you like to join us? Join the conversation? Not necessarily Alliance, just be part of it? Email me, Powell@stanford.edu. And we'd be happy to let you know what we're doing, include you in the conversation in any way we can. Thanks.
This time on Podcast Sampler, we've got Profile America, which is a podcast from the U.S. Census Bureau. It's a daily 60-second podcast focusing on interesting little bits of data from across the Census Bureau. The segment that we're going to hear was recorded on May 31st, 2007, and deals with gas rationing in World War II and relates that to today's high gas prices. And one good thing about this podcast is that it's intended for radio station spots. So if you're a podcaster and looking for filler or want to advance the cause of government information, consider going to the Profile America website and downloading some spots and dropping them into your podcast whenever appropriate. We'll have a link to Podcast America in the show notes. And now, since I've talked longer than the sample, here we go with Profile America.
Profile America, Thursday, May 31st. We may grumble about the price of gas when filling up our cars and trucks, but can you imagine what would be said if the government restricted us to 3 gallons a week? That's exactly what happened this month in 1942, as some states began rationing gasoline to help the war effort. By the end of the year, rationing was nationwide and remained in effect until the end of World War II, along with a national speed limit of 35 miles an hour. Now there are 120,000 gas stations across the country. Each year they sell a total of 174 billion gallons of gasoline. The average car consumes 560 gallons of fuel a year, while SUVs, vans, and pickups use 680 gallons. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau on the web at census.gov.
What did you think about today's show? Let us know. We have 3 ways you can give us feedback or make suggestions for future shows. Make a comment on the show blog at freegovinfo.info/blog/154. Send a text comment to admin, A-D-M-I-N, at freegovinfo.info. Record an audio comment up to 5 megabytes and email it to danielcornwall@gmail.com. Text messages will be read on the air, and audio comments will be played unless you ask us not to. We'd love to have some listener feedback to make our show better and to have more content. So if you like, love, or hate anything about our podcast, do let us know. Don't go away just yet. Today's song is yet to come. Today's outro music is the song Scary Guy by Maria Danes, an independent musician. I first heard this song a couple of months ago on the For Immediate Release podcast, and was just really impressed both with the energy and music of this particular song. And it wasn't on one of the PodSafe networks, so I wrote the musician for permission, and she kindly granted permission for it to be used here. And Scary Guy isn't just a song, it's also a movement. And a movement about eliminating hate and prejudice and violence in the world. And also has a core message of don't just sit there, do something, the world's a mess. And we think that fits in nicely with our message of librarians taking responsibility for their collections. Because if we don't stand up and take responsibility, others are going to do stuff in ways that we don't like. So sit back, listen to the song, and think about how you can use your positive energy to change the world. And we'll see you on FGI Podcast 3.
You heard about him, now he's in your face. He's in your school, man, he's every place. He's here for you and he's here for me. In 7 days you can see how good life can be.
Child takes an active role in teaching children how to teach love.